Okay, we're getting close to Hanukkah, and both in the calendar today and in history, and I think it's really important to make it a little bit deeper into the Greek calendar today. Before we get into the flow of time, and I promise you we're going to spend most of our time there, there's an outstanding question that was raised at the end of class last week that I don't want to answer, but I want to use it as a frame for what we're going to learn today. Yehoshua, who unfortunately is not sitting here right now, asked me somewhere toward the beginning or the middle of class, when I gave a description of the men of the Great Assembly, and I said, you know, it was really clear to them that this return was a preparation for the second exile, and that the theology of exile that I described in the Gemara and Yoma was really the way in which they understood history. So Yehoshua said to me, well, from a perspective of when Jewish consciousness actually emerged in its historical context, can you really say that's true? Can you really say that the spiritual leadership of Shivat Zion, of the actual return from the first exile and the early Second Temple period, understood things the same way that the Gemara, which of course is written well after the destruction of the Second Temple, so that Gemara Yoma happens to be in Hebrew, so my inclination would be to peg it somewhere in the early Amoritic period. So we'll call it 2nd, 3rd century of the Common Era. So we're talking about 400 or 500 years after the events that it's describing. Can you really say that that is a correct articulation of the way the leadership of the beginning, the early Second Temple period, felt? So my answer to that is not going to be a yes or no. My answer to it is that this is going to be an essential part of the conflict of the Greeks, which is when something new emerges in our understanding of the Torah, is it truly new? And therefore the people that are expressing it are basically bringing it from the outside, or is it that it was always there in Torah, and that this time period somehow, the nature of the leadership, the nature of the historical context, what have you, has caused it to emerge? Right? Why is this relevant to our discussion with Greece? Because it's the whole question of the Oral Torah. I'm trying to clear the way here, but he didn't come in. It's the whole question of the Oral Torah, right? You have the rabbis who are going to continue to return to the Torah, right? The Torah was given at Sinai. We'll call it, I don't know, 3,500, 4,000 years ago. It says what it says. And then you have this whole project of the Oral Torah, which on one level, right, traditionally we say the Oral Torah and the Written Torah were given together, right? Which basically solves this this conceptual problem by saying, no, everything that the Oral Torah says, it was always there. Although I don't think that actually is what the sages meant at all when they said that. Right? But another way of approaching it is that, oh yeah, everything is there within the Oral Torah, but it's waiting for the proper historical and cultural context to emerge. So we're going to see in particular when the crux moment of the Maccabean revolt comes, there's going to be a halakhic decision, which according to the first book of Maccabees, actually completely transforms the entire struggle and is what elevates the Hasmoneans to national leadership. We'll get to it, God willing, today. And the question is going to be, when they make that halakhic decision, when they look into the Torah and derive God's intention, was that to say God's intention was always such and had waited, hidden within the Torah, to this historical context to emerge? Or was it, no, sorry, God said what God said, and you rabbis, or you spiritual leaders of your generation, you're going to read it in if you really need to, in some attempt to have some authenticity and continuity, but the reality is that the Oral Torah is in discontinuity with the Written Torah. Do you guys understand the distinction? A very important distinction.
If you go with that, then you can say that if some rabbi today says you're allowed to drive on Shabbat, then he can say, well, it was always in the Oral Torah.
Absolutely.
Just revealed.
It is absolutely true that the project of the Oral Torah has not ended. All that's ended is any unity upon who has the authority to push it forward. Conservative movement in the 70s wrote a tshuva, you know, on a halakhic basis that permits Jews to drive to synagogue on Shabbat. I don't know if you're aware of that when you asked it. No, I've read the Tshuva, and it's quite, it is a classic architecture of halakhic thinking, which I think is deeply misguided, personally, in many of its decisions. But nevertheless, it's an attempt to do exactly that, to maintain a continuity of process, to derive something from the Torah, which on the surface of it is wholly new. Now, what does this have to do? So you guys understand the distinction? So what does this have to do with the Greeks? Is we're going to see in a minute that the Greeks were very interested in the written Torah. The idea that God gave a text to a people was not unique in the ancient world. Right? And once you have that text in your hands, you can say, well, what did God say? Well, let's unroll the scroll and see. What are the rabbis going to say? Well, you can't just unroll the scroll and see, because you have to talk to us about what it actually means. Because, of course, that scroll was given at Sinai 3,500, 4,000 years ago, but the Oral Torah is the project of applying an unchanging law to a constantly changing world. And therefore, when you apply an unchanging law to a constantly changing world, someone has to be able to say what God thinks about the world that I actually live in. There were no microwaves at Sinai. Right? And you can say that that's all rabbinic law, but that's not what the claim of the oral law is. There is also rabbinic law. But part of the claim of the oral law is that basically revelation never ends. That the nature of the relationship between Israel and Torah is to express the voice of God in every generation. And as Gal pointed out, you're absolutely correct. Someone today can look into the Torah and claim that God's intention is X, whatever X is. And the only question that's really going to be of relevance is whether everybody listens or not. Because you know the craziest thing is if there was centralized leadership in Am Yisrael today, and all these questions that are plaguing Am Yisrael, issues of gender, issues of sexuality, issues of power, issues of nationalism, all these things, if there was one central leadership that said, okay, everybody, take one step to the left, would we have moved?
Maybe.
No, the answer is no. Only relative to the people around us. If we all took that step together, we'll see that actually, as a people, that's continuity. And that's one of the things we're going to trace through time, is that up until the Gaonic era, there will be a central living religious authority, and that will allow a creativity and vision when it comes to articulating the divine will in history, which is absent once you get into the era of the Rishonim, of the early medieval authorities. So that's the path that we're going to tread on today, and I want to keep in mind as we start to talk about the Greeks. Okay, buckle your seatbelts, we're actually going to talk about some history. So we left off with the story of the meeting between Shimon the Tzaddik, Simon the Righteous, and Alexander. And no, that's mine, not yours. I can upload it if you want it, but I need it, otherwise I won't be able to teach. So in 332, before the Common Era, Alexander crosses the Hellespont. That's the bridge between Asia. You want some paper?
Yep.
Asia and Europe. We're not going to really discuss the nature of Alexander the Great in his personal Greek historic context, because that's not what we're getting to here. But suffice it to say, he is to this day considered to be one of the greatest conquerors in human history. Can't help it. One of the greatest conquerors in human history. And his conquest, he was basically looking for the outer seas. He was trying to get the end of the world. He made it all the way to the Indus Valley. By the way, he was only 18 years old when he began this conquest. Yeah, it's pretty astounding. And he makes it until 323 when he dies. Right? And the empire, which is embodied in his person, and by the way, he's, like I said, they still study his battles in military schools today. He's considered to be one of the great humans of all history. Take it or leave it. Right? We'll talk about what happens to the world when he dies, but in between, I do want to note that he founds Alexandria. I mean, it's fairly obvious where it gets its name.
Egypt.
Egypt, right, because there are actually a number of cities which are called Alexandria. Thank you.
Where is it in Egypt?
Where is it in Egypt? It's on the coast.
Didn't he name almost every city he...
On the coast, if I'm not mistaken, the western edge of the Nile Delta, but I would want to check that. I'm pretty sure it's the western edge of the Nile Delta. The Nile Delta is huge.
Is it still known as Alexandria?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Every major city got to conquer Alexandria.
Well, he also told all the priests that they had to name their children Alexander, right? Don't forget that in that meeting that we had between he and Shimon HaTzadik at the end of last week, there were two things that Alexander demanded. That all the priests of that year who were born named their children Alexander, though all the boys were born to be named Alexander, and that date, which was the beginning of his reign, be considered the starting date for the count of all court documents, right? What's called Minyan Shtarot, right? And we're going to come back to those things in the nature of the relationship, particularly the bridge that language serves between the Israelites, or actually we call them the Jews now because they're really becoming the Jews in Greek culture. But actually the most important bridge between the Jews and Greek culture is actually going to be Alexandria. Alexandria is founded as a Greek colony. It's something the Greeks have been doing for centuries, is colonizing. And a Greek polis city has a particular structure to it. Again, it's not a world history class. We're not going to go into the nature of the demos and what polis really was. But what's important for us is the concept of citizenry was bound up in the polis, meaning certain people were citizens, therefore had legal status. Other peoples were not and did not. the Jews, according to Josephus, were granted citizenship equivalent of the Greeks in Alexandria from day one. Now, there are many historians who dispute that, but nevertheless, we see that the Jews had a well-established Jewish, Greek-speaking Jewish community within Alexandria from the earliest recorded times. It's going to be very important for us because a unique culture is going to emerge out of Alexandria. The Greek-speaking Hebrew culture is going to be the roots of many things, not the least of which is what? Christianity. Because Christianity will be a melding of Greek philosophy with Jewish morality in many ways. So Alexandria is, we need to keep our eye on it. We need to keep our eye on it. And one of the great products of Alexandria will be Euclid. Euclid's Elements, because I do feel it's always necessary to place us in the context of world history. Why do Euclid's Elements matter? Anybody ever open the Elements? Anybody ever learn geometry? Right? It's the elements, basic elements of geometry. Oh, good. What's so important about geometry in terms of human thought? Don't tell me, oh, I hated geometry. Actually, I personally loved geometry. I thought it was the best part of math. It was all downhill after that. Right? calculus is, like, boring.
Perhaps because it's a unifying theories.
Unifying theories of what?
Of knowledge that all humanity agrees on.
I think the big thing is that everything is based on, you have to prove it. You have to prove it, uh-huh. Otherwise it's not true.
So it's both. It's a logical structure which cannot be refuted. You move from axioms to postulates, from postulates to theorems, right? And once you've got that structure, it cannot be argued with. And it is not just a localized approach to the fact that there's only one line that is perpendicular to a line that can pass through a point, right? But it's also a universal assertion about how the human mind works. That the mind itself, if I close this, I'll actually start to get up. That the mind itself has logical structures which can be trusted to know the world, and that once one knows the world through those logical structures, right, then... Hang on a second. And that once one knows the world through those logical structures, it cannot be refuted. It's very important because the Greeks are going to come on strong. The mind is the way to know the truth. And the Jews are almost on board with that. That meeting between Shimon HaTzadik and Alexander was not a meeting of minds. It was a meeting of beauty, right? The 10-foot-tall Greek with the ostrich plume, right? The flowing, bearded, you know, multicolored priest with all the white-robed priests behind him. That meeting of beauty is very important because beauty in our world, right? What's the study of beauty in modern philosophical terms called?
Aesthetics,
excellent. Right? Aesthetics was a word that was invented in the 18th century as part of the Enlightenment in order to remove the original classical meaning because beauty and truth were assumed to be united in classical thought. If not united, then certainly deeply related. Right? And the pre-Euclidean mathematics, Pythagoras, I don't know if you guys know anything about like the early mystics of numbers, but certainly their sense of that symmetry indicated divine intention, and therefore the experience of beauty was close to truth. And the Jews got that because you know why? It leaves your experience as a central element of your ability to know truth. And let's not forget, your mind is just part of your experience, right? Right? And therefore, it opens up the question is, what is the primary tool for experience? Where do you actually contact the world? Right? So Euclid is the beginning of reductionism. We're gonna push out anything which can't be quantified from axiom to postulate to theorem, neatly categorized, and therefore in sort of like irrefutable logic. And the Jews, like that, like we're very enamored of the power of thought which is available, and yet we base our notions of truth on what?
Revelation.
Which is the most irrational approach to truth there can be. Why is it true? Well, because God said so. Okay, we can go round and round with that one.
God and succeeding prophets.
And what's even worse, God, succeeding prophets, and?
The rabbis.
The rabbis. Right? Because it's one thing to say God. Okay, we're all down with that. Oh, succeeding prophets. Remember, the age of prophecy is over. Don't forget, one of our proof texts from Seder Olam Rabba said, when did the age of prophecy end? When Alexander appeared. Right? Because prophecy has to do with imagination. Right, Rav Kook writes extensively how the imagination is a critical element of prophecy. How could it not be? Because how on earth am I as a human being going to relate to something like God if it's not through some leap of holy imagination? Right? When Alexander comes along, the world of the intellect begins to rise and becomes the pillar of Western culture to this very day, although it's begun to crumble in face of the postmodern attacks, which I think, by the way, is good news for the Jews, lest you be afraid of postmodernism. No, very good news for the Jews. Just going to take us a little while to figure out how to work with it. Never be afraid of it. The end of prophecy and the rise of wisdom...
On that.
That's next year.
Okay.
The end of prophecy and the rise of wisdom jibes quite nicely on one level with the appearance of Greek philosophy and the sort of front-loading of the mind. But remember I told you is that if the Greeks leave the mythic era and enter the philosophical era, then the Jews are leaving the prophetic era and entering the era of wisdom, which I like to call the Midrashic era. And one of the things that we're going to come to eventually is what's the difference between Midrash and allegory? Because, you know, the Greek wisdom, Aesop's fables, all the allegorical approach, are going to be very different than Midrash. And that's a question we're just going to kind of leave up there in the air, and we will get to, because I do want to cover some historical ground. But Alexandria, for our purposes, what happens there is there's a Greek-speaking Jewish community, which is an organic part of the culture which emerges there. And Alexandria also represents the jewel in the crown of the whole Hellenistic approach. What is Hellenism? What is Hellenism? Right, the Hellenic world, the classical Greek world, was like every other classical world, like the Jewish classical world. It was self-referential. Right? Remember we spoke about this era of the what I call the Pshat era and the Drash era in the Jewish life of like the adolescents. Right? Adolescents are consumed by their own ideas. They don't really believe that people outside of themselves exist in any meaningful sense. And because of that, they're able to generate very powerful ideas. And there's that creative element within all of us that needs to allow ourselves to be consumed by our own ideas before we can expose them to others. Right? So that's the classical era in most cultures. They're not referential. They're self-referential. But we're entering into this age of drush, of the compare and contrast. That the Hellenistic era is when Greek culture begins to meld with the Asiatic cultures. Right? And building a city like Alexandria and all the other Greek colonies that were built, where even a new language emerges. What do the people in these cities speak? I said Greek. It's actually a misnomer. They speak a language called Koine, right? Which is, it's the Yiddish of the Greek-speaking world, so to speak. Do you want to use a real historical anachronism? What?
It's like a Creole.
It's a Creole. It's
between Hebrew.
Not always Hebrew. It's local language and Greek. Koine was a blanket term.
There were different. Not specifically.
Not specifically, although here they spoke one, which was a major between Hebrew and Greek. It was still Hebrew here at that point. Aramaic was is much later advent. Not much later, but.
That's where the Creole works, because there's all these different types of Creoles that are all based on French and the local language.
Right. And it's a similar cultural amalgamation. So, it matters for us in our story is because there's another very important book on the horizon. You know, it's so funny. You spend so much time thinking about these things. They go by in 30 seconds. There's another very important book on our horizon, and that is, this is Septuagint. What is the Septuagint? What does it mean? What is it? Anybody know? What? No idea. It's, in Hebrew, we call it the Targum Shivim, which is what the word Septuagint in Greek is referring to, the 70. The Targum Shivim is the translation of the 70. It is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. You get a sticker after class.
Yeah.
Right? Hearing rest. Right? That's all that matters. Now, we're going to speak about its significance at length in terms of Hebrew culture, but you should understand something. That not only is it significant for Hebrew culture, this is the first major work which is translated from an Oriental language into Greek. Which means that aside from our particular issues as a Jewish people about translating the Bible, this is an event in world culture. And one of the questions that we ought to ask is, why this? Why is it that the Hebrew Bible is actually the first? I mean, obviously there were documents that were translated before that, you know, and et cetera. But the first major work, and it's quite a major work, open up the Bible, if you haven't done it yet, it's big, right? That people actually sat down and said, this must be translated into Greek. And anybody here who's ever done any translation knows that in order to translate something, you have to some degree be a master of both languages. Which means you also have to, in some degree, be a master of both
cultures,
because language is not a code for meaning. Have we had that discussion? Yes? Yes, we've had that discussion. It'll keep coming up. It's not a code for meaning. Language is a nexus for relationship. And therefore, the Septuagint represents, to some degree, another amalgamation of Greek and Jewish cultures. Right? What is the story behind the Septuagint? Well, as is true with most stories, it depends on who you ask. Right? The oldest record we have of the translation of the Bible into Greek is in a book called a document called the Letter of Aristeas. Right? It purports to be a letter from a Jew in Jerusalem to his brother in Alexandria, discussing many things. Amongst them, the desire of Ptolemy II to translate the Hebrew Bible and place it in the library at Alexandria, which was a real thing. It's not a mythic. Some of the Greeks were interested in collecting knowledge. Okay, and there he discusses the fact that 72 elders were chosen. Why 72 elders were chosen to translate the Bible? Do the math. 72 is?
70 plus 2.
Well, 70 plus 2, but it's also 6 times 12.
Times 6.
Or 12 times 6, depending on how you think. Right? I'm meaning 6 from every tribe, right? This is notion that you know, you wanted to get all the tribal perspectives and bring them together into one thing, right? The Gemara, Josephus also tells the story. He tells it as 70, because the 70 was the number of the Sanhedrin, right? The Gemara in Megillah, that we're going to just peek at in a second, which I uploaded for you guys to the Dropbox, you know, documents, says that it was actually 72. And why was the reason that the Gemara gave that they were all taken and shut in separate rooms? Because the Greeks didn't trust them to translate it honestly. The Greeks had a suspicion, according to Gemara, that there was some stuff in there that the Jews wouldn't want us to know, and therefore they took 72 rabbis and put them in separate rooms and had them translate the Torah, and a great miracle happened, and they all translated the same. They, of course, knew nothing about Jews, because they would have realized it would have been a greater miracle if you put 70 rabbis in one room and actually had it come out the same. But aside from that problem, the...
So they were basically forced to translate it. This is like, hey, please
well,
do this work for us.
Careful. This is how the story is told. And it's how the story is told by Jews. When the letter of Aristeas is a Jewish document, Josephus is certainly a Jewish document, despite his political failings, as we'll see later in our class. The Gemara is the quintessential Jewish document. We don't really have a Greek perspective on the translation itself. And it is likely that the translation, first of all, it's pretty clear from the critical analysis of the document that the five books of the Torah were translated more or less at one time, and that the rest of the Bible were translated another. Also, because in the Septuagint, that's a tough word, right, as it is today, there are a couple of books that don't exist in the Hebrew Bible. The Maccabees, first and second Maccabees, are in the Septuagint, which are also in the Christian Bible, and they're not, of course, in the Masoretic text. They also... the book of Esdras. What?
Isn't that before the Hanukkah story?
Well, when it was translated is a very important question. That's why I said likely this date is the date of the five books of Moses. And then over the next couple of centuries, each book was incorporated. We're going to get to the books of Maccabees and when they were written and why, God willing, today. If not today, certainly next week, because we're certainly into the Hanukkah story now. Right? It is important to note that we're going to get to this first. Well, we know that the Septuagint Philo, who is an important figure of the late Second Temple period, that we'll discuss in his own right, but he reports that it was already used for public Torah readings in Alexandria in the first century before the Common Era, meaning it had not only existed, but had become accepted by the Jewish world. It's very important that the original translation was by Jews for Jews. That's what seems to be clear from all the Jewish sources. However, today, if you start talking about the Targum Shittim as the source for your theology, you know what people will do? Brand you as a Messianic Christian. Because today it's seen as the archetypical text for the Christian world. Now, how did that happen?
Because there were so many Jews in Alexandria that were only speaking Greek at that point. So.
It's very important. It's very important. There was a thriving cultural base of Jews in Alexandria who, I don't know if they only spoke Greek, but Greek was certainly their native language. Certainly the educated ones, like Philo and other people, they certainly mastered Hebrew. Philo was reading the Bible in the original. He has all kinds of critical comparisons between the Septuagint and the Hebrew Bible. But you guys know what day of the year we mark the translation of the Septuagint every year as Jews?
Tishba.
Not Tishba, although you're close.
Tenth of
Tevet.
Tenth of Tevet. Right on the 10th of Tevet, which is, in the terms of the cycle of the destruction of the temple, the day that the siege was laid, right, marks many other things, right, amongst them the death of Ezra Sofer, right, and the translation of the Targum Shuvim. The translation of the Bible into Greek is a cause for mourning and fasting. Now, that in of itself is interesting, but what if I told you that if you opened up the Book of Devarim, and you looked in the 27th chapter, you'd see a pasuk that says, you shall write upon the stones all the words of this Torah very clearly. Be'er heitev. And Rashi on that word, be'er heitev, says what? What did Moshe do when he wrote out the Torah? He wrote it out in all 70 languages on big stones. You're on it today, right? And big stones, and put them at the entrance to Eretz Israel. So wait a minute. How can it be that we as Jews are mourning the translation of the Bible into Greek to this very day, whether you knew it or not?
Moshe
right?
Rabbeinu himself?
And Moshe Rabbeinu translating to all 70 languages. What's up with that? What's the distinction?
Did Moshe throw them in the river?
No, for sure not. Well, what part of the answer is, in what your non-joking side, man, is that Moshe's, of course, were located where? At the entrance to Eretz Israel. The idea being that all the nations of the world could come, see what it says in their own language, and say, wow, Gevalt, there's a people that's actually following this thing? Let's go on in and see what that looks like. Where was the Targum Shuvim resident? In Alexandria.
Gaulis.
In Alexandria, yeah. Well, Gaulis is a concept in formation. We'll just call it Alexandria for now, right? Wait, so this represents a much deeper problem, which is that the people in Alexandria, like David pointed out, are Greek speakers. You show a Greek speaker a Greek copy of the Septuagint of the Bible, what language is this person going to assume it was written in?
Greek.
And therefore, if you then show them a Hebrew Bible, which is going to have significant differences, there's a whole world of critical scholarship that sits with the Septuagint and the Hebrew Bible and goes back and forth about what the differences are. Some of those differences are theological, and it's clear that they're also Christological, meaning they're later Christian interpolations into the Greek text, because the way texts pass down through time is never simple. That's why there's a whole profession that the Jews have developed called Sofrim, right, whose primary job is to never change anything. Just think about that. It's a profession whose primary job is to never change anything, right? Right? That's one thing. Another thing, it seems that the Hebrew text from which the Septuagint was translated was not the same as the Masoretic text.
This was not my question. So yes. When you say the Hebrew text, we don't have something that's...
We do not have the Ur text. Right? This, by the way, is in Orthodoxy not a comfortable thought.
The Ur. I mean, in fact, this is the oldest text.
Let me be more clear. It's very important that you understand this.
Okay.
No, or meaning, or text is an expression in source criticism, meaning that you have the original text from which all other latter texts are derived. Because the Septuagint, at the end of Ha'azinu, the Moshe's final poem in Devarim, ends very different in the Septuagint than it does in the Hebrew Bible as we currently have. And just to make it worse, there's something called the Samaritan Pentateuch. They love these names, right? Which is written in Hebrew, which is also different. And remember the Samaritans, those are those guys who claim to be the Jews, all the way back in the time of Ezra. So you have three texts, all of which are different.
But the Hebrew Bible that you're talking about is the Masoretic, was found in the
Hebrew Bible we have was completed in later in the 6th, probably more like the 8th, 8th, 9th. And we'll get there in this class. Right? But the question is, of course, when the translator of the Septuagint was working, was he working with a more authoritative text? In which case we have to ask the question why the rabbis decided that the other text was the correct one. Was he working with a variant text, in which case it makes a lot of sense why the rabbis would have said the Septuagint is not acceptable because he had the wrong text. Right? Or, what's the third option? Are we just back projecting our own theological issues on a bunch of people who didn't have them?
They had
multiple versions of text and considered them all to be sacred. Because our relationship to text is very different. Like I pointed out to you, if I sent you a copy of this, what would you do?
Xerox.
Or send me the digital, right? That our relationship to text is founded on its immutability, not only theologically, because you've all heard it 1,000 times, probably, especially if you were raised in religious schools, right? Every letter that says in the Torah of Moshe, right, came with Moshe down from Sinai, or you're a heretic, right? Probably in that voice, right? You combine that theological imperative together with our technological experience, and you say, yeah, of course. And you ever see a sofer stam? They're very serious. It's a whole profession. Sofer stam, the guys who write for it, it's a whole profession which is devoted to never changing anything. What could be more orthodox? It's not so clear that in the Second Temple times they related to text. I'm sorry, it is very clear in the Second Temple times they didn't relate to text that way. Because, of course, we're, you know, almost 2,000 years before the printing press. Right? Number one. Number two, you ever see the Gemara that says that Rebbe Meir had a Sefer Torah that when it said God made clothes of wool with an iron for Adam and Eve, that Rebbe Meir had a Sefer Torah that said that it made clothes of ore with an aleph? What does that mean? Now, you could say it's a midrashic, you know, they don't really mean he had a separate Sefer Torah, it means Rebbe Meir, you know, I had like to read things differently. Okay, but it didn't say Rebbe Meir like to say Al Tikre or Ela or, because it says that all the time in the Gemara. Don't read it with an iron, read it with an aleph. It says it all the time. It says, no, Rebbe Meir had a Sefer Torah, and it said it with an aleph and not an iron.
Wow.
Right? It is not so clear, I think, when you look in the Gemara, that the integrity of the text was such as it is post Korban Bayit Sheni, post Second Temple destruction, because, and this is the real point I'm trying to make, there was no Judaism in the Second Temple period. There was no Judaism in the Second Temple period. There were the Jews, there was the Temple, there was the Torah, there was the land of Israel, and there were lots of very different opinions about how all those things were meant to fit together. It's only after the destruction and the need to completely boil down and clarify who we are as disconnected from a national religious center, the temple, and a physical geographic location, the land of Israel, that the critical necessity of having an ism will arise. Which an ism is the ultimate expression of religion. A set of beliefs, behaviors, and practices which define your relationship with God. And if you're outside of those things, you know what you are?
Heretic.
Or goy. Take your pick. Right? Whereas, in the time that we're living in here, wasn't so clear. As we're going to see in a few minutes, wasn't so clear. The whole Hellenistic movement within Judaism was not an attempt to become Greeks. It was an attempt to make Judaism something else. So, the Septuagint, now we can understand why that the rabbis were not enamored of it. And there's one more piece, and this is actually very important in the historical arc, is that the early church fathers who had the Septuagint and also the Hebrew Bible and were scholars enough to... I should have printed that up for you guys. I thought the angle could be good. They were scholars enough to read them both. Are going to claim that the Septuagint is divinely inspired. It's a divinely inspired translation, and therefore it reflects the Word of God more precisely than the Hebrew Bible. Now, this is consistent with Christian theology. You know what it is? It's supersession theology in text. Just as Christianity, in its covenant with God, reflects a more clear expression of the will of God. Like the Jews came along, they did their thing, they failed. God chose us being the church, and we are now new Israel. So too, the Jews received the Bible in their Hebrew language, which was kind of crude and culturally limited. But once an inspired translation into Greek, which is the language of culture, the language of philosophy, the language of the world, due to Hellenism, once that came along, that's actually God's intention. And now you can understand why we mourn the translation of the Bible into Greek on Asarbatavit, because it was the last blow, or last stick, I would say, in the hands of the early church fathers to try to beat into the Jews and anybody else who wanted to argue that the church was the new Israel.
What does Septuagint mean?
It means the 70 in Greek. Okay. This is a big event, and one of the ways the Mishnah deals with it, lest you think it was all bad, you know, the Mishnah says there's no difference between mezuzah and tefillin and a Sefer Torah, except, right, that a Sefer Torah can actually be written in Greek. Not to use necessarily for ritual purposes, but that the Mishnah specifically says that a Sefer Torah can be written in Greek. Why Greek? What is a translation? Is a translation a literal sort of like copying of thought from one language to another?
Interpretation.
Not possible. It's always an interpretation. On some level, it's always an interpretation. And don't forget, in the rabbinic mind, where does interpretation lie? In the text or in the reader?
In the writer?
Well, okay.
In between the lines.
You can get into like this, right? There is a sofer, that's a writer. There is a sipur, that's the story. And then there is a sefer. And then, of course, there's a reader. And if you really want to go far, there's also a sapir, but that's a different discussion up there. God is the author. And in any good story, the author predates the story on some level, right? And then there's a story. And somehow that story gets written down, and then the reader comes along and reads it. Up until the postmodern era, we thought this was a very neat line, right? The reader is reading what it says in the book, which is the story, which is intended by the author, right? Derrida comes along and kills all the authors, right? And completely makes it up. The book and the end of literary criticism, anybody? I'm probably too far afield. Anyway, the rabbis understood full well that meaning always resides in the reader.
Oh,
thank you. They understood full well that meaning always resides in the reader. This is not a chiddush of literary criticism. Right? And therefore, if you make a translation, what you're doing is basically taking the reader and using the reader to smother the text. You get one layer of the text. You get the reader's interpretation, and their contention is that you kill the writer and the story, and you're left with just the book. And therefore, you cannot continue to return as a new reader. How is it possible that I'm still reading the Parsha every week, right? 3,500, 4,000 years after the Torah was given, and I'm still looking for new stuff in it. And, you know, every once in a while, it comes up for me. And I'm not the only one, obviously. How is that possible? It's because the assumption that okay, it's all in there. And that's where we started the class. Oh, sure, it's all in there. For sure, it's all in there. Except it's waiting for what? For someone in the year 5776 with my cultural background and intellectual abilities and educational training to look for it. Or not to look for it, to just look at it and to allow whatever else is there and you and you and you and you. Remember we talked about that's why the men of the Great Assembly started the rabbinic project by raising up many students. Because the more students are in the game, the more that will come out. That process never ends. But if you translate it, you just basically strip it down to one level. And then the Greeks just say, great, we have this thing called Torah, put it in the library. And we'll see how that plays itself out with Hasmoneans. All right, Ad Kan Septuagint, because I can keep going. But
it's kind of scary. I heard you make a comment just about, you know, how today we send the digital version.
Mm-hmm.
But today, and moving forward, a future trend in technology is text analysis, algorithmic, text learning.
Yep.
We're not even going to have to read in the future the digital version, and digital tech is going to do all the work for us. I mean, I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I hear it. Maybe I'll say one thing about biblical criticism right now, because it's what came up for me when you said that. I've dabbled a little bit in source criticism. I mean, it's obvious for those of you who are familiar with Orthodoxy that what I'm expressing here is not normative Orthodox thought, although it will be. Don't worry. Don't be afraid of textual criticism. But don't be so enamored of it unless it can actually teach you something. That's the wisdom of the sages. Like, oh, as Rabbi Barminder said, nobody ever died from a kasha. Oh, you got a good challenge? You want to say that it wasn't written this way, it was written that way? First of all, it's all an argument about mechanism. Right? All the arguments of textual criticism are about how did the text that we have today reach its current form? And it's never about meaning. Once it becomes about meaning, then we'll have something to talk about. If people want to talk about mechanism, they can spend their time talking about mechanism, and I'll spend my time learning Torah. People want to actually say, but because I have an insight from the mechanism, now we can ask questions about meaning, then we have something really to speak about. Because the real question that's on the table today has nothing to do with the text, and has everything to do with authority. And that brings us right back around to the sages. How could the sages, or their intellectual inheritors, a few generations later, having known what they know, because of course they knew everything I just said to you, and a lot more, I imagine, since they actually lived in this environment, how could they then say later, every letter that it says in the Sefer Torah came down like Moshe, with Moshe from Sinai? How can they say it with a straight face? Were they just telling us a lie to keep us in bounds? I don't think so. Not at all. I think they were doing us a tremendous favor, because what they were doing is freeing us from pedantic questions of mechanism and opening up to us the whole realm of meaning. Another way of saying that is, okay, now that we agree that this is the text, we have freed its meaning. Because they'll say, you can't argue about whether this is the text or not, and now we can argue about whether it means everything and is opposite. Because that's what they always cared about. They only cared about meaning. Mechanism was only useful in so far as it was a vehicle for meaning.
And even still, the way we might interpret that statement, when you drush a hey or a vav or a nuances, even though we're expressing this seeming gap of fidelity, i.e., well, if there's different versions, then how can you ascribe absolute meaning to these nuances of the text?
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're they might say there's no difficulty. What's absolute meaning for us today is not absolute meaning for them over there. For them, it's more poetic in a way, where absolute meaning is sort of has a different application. It's got a different picture.
We suffer from a smallness when we say the word absolute meaning.
Yeah.
Because our need for absolute meaning is something I can comprehend. Comprehend in English means to completely surround something and contain it. Right? Whereas their relationship to absolute meaning was something which you stood before in awe. Which you cannot comprehend. Which you can approach. Which you can pass, touch, and fall away.
It's much
more creative because their relationship with God was live. And unfortunately what we're going to see in this whole development of the theology of exile is that the relationship with God is going to be buried in the text. It's going to be buried in the halachic project. For good reasons. I mean, and we're going to get to this as we move through the destruction of the Second Temple. And its roots really lie here.
So you're saying that the Torah is basically a mean as opposed to itself, the embodiment of holiness?
I didn't say that. The Torah is the physical Torah that we have in our art there is the best fit that we have. Listen, the Midrash says when Moshe went up on Sinai and got the Torah from God, that the tablets, that it says God held two tefachim, Moshe held two tefachim, and there was a space of two tefachim between them. Why? Because how on earth could Moshe ever bring God's Torah down to earth? Davar Torah b'lashon b'nei Adam. The Torah speaks in the language of man. That doesn't mean it just uses the language that we're going to understand. It means that the context within the Torah, within which the Torah embodies itself, is the human context. And part of that human context is the historical context. And that means that this text was given to somebody at some time, who gave it to somebody else, who gave it to somebody else, who lived in some culture that decided that this was important and that wasn't. And that process cannot be ignored. Now, there's a point in history, starting with Ezra. Remember we looked at that Gemara? That Ezra was the one who changed the Torah? That if Moshe hadn't brought the Torah down from Sinai, it would have been Ezra? Right? There was a point at which the necessity to make a clear playing field in order that consciousness can be born. The birth of consciousness is a messy process, like all birth. Sorry, I don't want to go into detail, but you think about it. You end up with this perfect, sweet little child and a tremendous mess and waste. What's that? What is all the rest of that? And anybody who's been through the process knows, what it is? The necessary stuff of life. Right? And so in order for the consciousness, which can still know God all these years later, which can still reach into the Torah and continue that process of revelation, as broken as it is, and as limping as we are, nevertheless, in order for that to happen, it needs a vessel which is quite strong. It needs a womb which can give birth to consciousness. And in many ways, that's what the Torah is. With all the mess that's involved in that. And the word that Gary used that was so important to me is creativity. Our fear of creativity today is rampant, and a lot of it has to do with how broken the structures, our social and religious structures, are. Like I said, I'm going to get back into the flow of time for the last 15 minutes of class, but I just want to give you one image to contain this. Anybody ever take a lulav in shul? Right? Everybody's got their method. Everybody learned at some point. Either you learned because when you were a kid, or you learned because you were later in your life. They taught you before you go forward, and then you go to the right, and you go left, or you go north and south, and all these things. And you look around in shul. Have you ever taken the chance to look around in shul? It looks a little bit ridiculous. It's like six guys are going this way, and the other guy's going that way, right? But you picture what it must have been like in the Beit HaMikdash. Tens of thousands of people surrounding this one point, and as soon as they began, everybody went forward, right, back. Yeah. The synchronicity of it. You know what would happen if they built the temple today? It is a dance. Not like a dance. It is a dance. Right? And you know what would happen if they built the temple today? People would be smacking each other. You're supposed to go left, right. Chaos. Chaos. And because of that sense, we're so afraid to make any change or any significant move. Because it's like everybody who's made a change, a significant move, is no longer a part of the story. We're clinging to the remnants. But it's all because we haven't accepted, in my opinion, the fact that there's a new vessel. Where are we having this conversation? We're not in Brooklyn anymore. So moving forward. The Septuagint really, along with all these children naming themselves Alexander, represents two sides of this story. One is the incredible synthesis which happened almost like that. Between Jewish and Greek culture. I mean, there was love at first sight. The Greeks were the first culture the Jews had ever met who were committed as a culture in the quest for meaning and truth. And therefore, the tools that they applied were astounding. The rabbis loved it. You can see it. Antigonus of Socho is the disciple of Shimon HaTzadik. Just listen to the name. Antigonus. Right? Shimon. That's a good Jewish name. Antigonus. Right? Like, what's that? You see, right away, they had no fear of the culture. And there was a melding, and not only had no fear of it, but, I mean, this was a world culture which showed itself to be supreme. It was an admiration, right? And what began to happen was the slide into Greek culture. And the turning point for us is going to be represented in 175. See, the Diadochi, these generals who inherited Alexander's empire, duked it out for, I don't know, about 20, 30 years until they came to some level of stability. There were four kingdoms that rose out of Alexander's empire. The Pergamon and Macedon, they don't care about. They're like basically in modern-day Turkey and Greece. They're not really part of our story. But what we really care about for our story is Ptolemaic Greece, that's based in Egypt, right? And the Seleucid Empire, which you're all familiar with from the Hanukkah story, which is based in present-day Syria, if such a place still exists. Right? So the king in Syria that we're all familiar with is Antiochus Epiphanes, and there's some questions about whether his name was Epiphanes, whether it was madman or, you know, the divinely inspired. We're going to get into that for right now. We'll just call him Antiochus because we all know the name. Right?
Antiochus Sex, Jerusalem.
Well, yeah, actually, there's his name on the board, so therefore, it must be him, right? In approximately 175, I say approximately because everybody always debates these numbers by a couple of years, but it's good enough for us, 175, a priest named Jason, notice the name, you don't get more Greek than that, goes to Antiochus and begs him on the behalf of a significant portion of the population of Jerusalem to make him high priest, for which he offers a large bribe, and to declare Jerusalem a polis, which he wants to name Antioch in admiration of the capital city of the Seleucid Empire, which was actual Antioch. Right? And in case you think making Jerusalem was a polis was a simple thing, that the core element of polis is the gymnasium. The gymnasium is not just a place where people work out. It is the cultural, educational, religious center of Greek culture. Right? It is a place where the games are held, sacrifices to the gods are made, and where education is promulgated. And most importantly for the Jews, right, how are those games conducted?
Naked.
In the nude. And you might think, like, what do I care? Right? Ah, no. It's very important because now the issue is really at hand. Because if your games are held clothed, and if, you know, who you're worshiping in the privacy of your own home is a matter of, like, what you do in your backyard is what you do, and what I do is my doing. Don't. That's something. But when it's in public and you're naked, you'll now know who is for the Greeks and who's against them, because many Jews are now showing their adherence to the Greek culture by undergoing what's known as epispasm, which is the reversal of the covenant of circumcision. Yes, it is possible. is not just impossible in the era of modern plastic surgery, but it was something which was being done in the Greek era because the Greek, remember their truth is beauty thing? So I got a very simple question for you. If you believe in like the Platonic ideal, meaning that there's something called beauty which transcends its manifestation in the physical world, and the physical world reaches its beautiful and therefore true being by reflecting that ideal, and the human body in the Greek experience is one of the great expressions of beauty. Therefore, the most perfect human being is what? The one who is most beautiful and is most reflective of nature. So therefore, circumcision is the ultimate mutilation. It's not just the ultimate mutilation, it's the ultimate denial that man is a product of the gods. Because who are you, human being, to come along and ruin that which God made perfect? Right? The Greek athlete on the field represents the perfection of humanity and therefore the divine expression of beauty and truth. Well, the Jewish people say not exactly the opposite, but something which is slightly different, which is, who is it that brings perfection into the world?
The Greeks.
The Jews.
The Jewish people.
Humanity. We can get into the Jewish people thing or the Greeks, you know. Humanity. Right? This is the famous discussion between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, right? Which happens much later in history, but doesn't matter for ours. Right? That Turnus Rufus asks him, whose works are more perfect, man's or God's? You're thinking that the rabbi will say, of course, God's. And Rabbi Akiva says, of course, man's. Why? Because which one would you rather eat, wheat or bread? And the conversation goes on, and eventually comes around to what Turnus Rufus was really asking about, which is circumcision. Because what does circumcision represent? It represents the idea that we are partners in creation. In the same way that everything is imminent within a text, but only emerges when there's a reader who can interact with that text on a level that can bring it out in its current cultural and historical context, so too, whatever it is the world needs to be right now, it becomes through the actions of human consciousness. And circumcision is the last act of creation in the physical sense, and it represents the covenant with God that the Jews believe that we were put in the world to not finish creation, because creation is never finished, but to be partners in creation. And therefore, it itself is a sign of beauty. Now you see why this is a big argument there about you know, throwing naked discus in the fields of Jerusalem, aside from the sneeze, which of course is a big problem. But so Jason succeeds. He becomes high priest. He doesn't quite get Jerusalem recognized as a polis, but he does begin to build a gymnasium and conduct Greek games here. Right?
In Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem.
Do we know where that is?
Oh, where his gymnasium was? I don't know. It's possible. We just recently uncovered some major Greek, the Acha Fortress, which was the major Greek fortification near Davia. I went and saw it on Thursday. No, what day? Today's Thursday. I went and saw it on Monday. Wow, I've been sick, right? I was in bed basically from then until this morning. Where did the rest of the week go? It's pretty amazing, the scale of what they built. But he succeeds, but you know, gosh, there's always somebody more radical than you, right? Now, Jason was a Hellenist, but he was part of a Hellenistic party, and that's what I don't want you to miss in this. He wasn't some individual radical who became high priest, threw lots of money, and everybody hated him. He represented a whole camp within Am Yisrael, within Jerusalem in particular, right? But he was too mellow for Menelaus. Notice the name, right? Because when Menelaus actually managed to go full force, and they wanted to become Greeks. Oh, they're going to have their national temple, but they wanted to be Greeks holy. And the whole power struggle, which it's not worth it to us to detail the power struggle there, but the reason it matters is that it goes back and forth. Jason becomes high priest. Let's see, I'm going to keep the numbers straight here. And then about 4 years later, Menelaus plots against him, seizes the priesthood. And then in 169, Jason actually manages to reconquer Jerusalem. Yeah, they're going back, Jews, going back and forth in Jerusalem, fighting each other about who's going to be more Hellenistic. Because the ones that actually want to be Jews at this point are leaving Jerusalem rapidly.
So this now, priesthood is almost like a mouthful.
The priesthood has become, remember, there's no kingship. The leaders of the Jews when we came back, who's the last leader in that first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, or the second Mishnah? Shimon HaTzadi, he's the high priest. High priest is the cultural leader right now. He's the one that goes out and meets Alexander. And of course, the Hasmoneans, who become actual kings eventually, are also priests. This is one of the reasons, potentially, that the priesthood loses all of its status in the rabbinic mind. And that's why they say, a mamzer who learns Torah is better than a high priest who's an ignoramus. The rabbis had no love for the priests after this. So our turning point here, and I got a good 3 minutes left. That's like a wealth of time. Turning point really happens is you got to remember that all these events would be very minor tribal struggles amongst a bunch of people who seem to not be able to decide what they want to be, Greek or Jewish, if it weren't for one very important fact, that these minor tribal struggles amongst these stiff-necked people are taking place on the fault line between the two major empires of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic. Up until this time, it was the Ptolemaic Greek Empire, that's the Egyptian-based empire, which controlled Eretz Israel. Why is Antiochus interested at all in who's going to be the high priest in Jerusalem? He could care less. Okay, money is good. Money is good. You want to give a lot of money? Fine. No, he's interested in pushing the Egyptians out of this border region.
And this Jason guy was from the Seleucids, not...
Which he was a Jew. No, he was a Jew. He went to the Seleucids in an attempt to bring them in as the power to back him. The Seleucids were willing to do it because that was a way of pushing the Egyptian Ptolemaic influence back into Egypt. Antiochus finally decides he's going to march in 169. He marches on the Ptolemaic Empire with elephants and troops and the whole thing down the coastal road. Right? He defeats them, but his defeat, or his victory, I should say, is sapped of its meaning because another regional power steps in and says, back off, you can't destroy the Ptolemaic Empire. You know who it is? Rome. This is the first appearance of Rome in our story. Rome appears as the power broker in the region by preventing the Seleucid Empire from destroying the Ptolemaic Empire and consolidating its power. Why, first of all, why would Rome care? Divide and conquer. Rome, of course, is eventually going to conquer this whole region. Better for them that there's a bunch of remnants of Alexander's empire fighting each other and keeping each other weak and off balance than having one united Greek kingdom. We're going to see that plays itself out because the Jews are smart enough to turn to Rome, and ultimately, at the end of the Hasmonean period, it'll be the Jews that bring Rome to Jerusalem, just like it was the Jews that brought the Greeks. So, I got 1 minute, and we'll end on this note. So, Antiochus, on his way back from Egypt, is in a foul mood, having been denied the real sweetness of his victory, and by the way, the plunder that his army really needed in order to pay them. So he decides, after hearing that he doesn't even know Jason Menelaus, who's in charge of Jerusalem right now, I don't really care, open the gates of Jerusalem, or I'm going to sack the place. They fools that they are opening the city, and what does he do? He sacks it. I mean, Jerusalem is a very strong fortified city, even in this day. They perhaps would not have been able to get in if someone hadn't opened the gates. Right? He sacks it. And over the next year and a half, an idol is placed in the temple, and Antiochus, according to the Book of Maccabees, declares that all the peoples of his empire shall be as one, also participate in the Greek culture, and he bans the learning of Torah, circumcision, the sanctification of the new moon, and the keeping of the Sabbath. Right? These are all the edicts, which are either response to Jewish stiff-neckedness and indecision, or the cause of the rebellion of Hanukkah, which is going to be just around the corner. And that's where we'll pick up next week. We're going to stop there. Sure.